Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room, the speaker is Stephen Zunis. He will be speaking on the prospects for Israeli-Palestinian peace. So let's listen in on Stephen Zunis.
Well, we begin. I guess I'd like to start just a moment of silent prayer, meditation, reflection. Say their names and where they're from, and if there's anything about the issue of the Israeli-Palestinian peace that people want to see addressed. Also, as a reminder, if you've been to either or both of my previous sessions on the Middle East issues.
Pat Moore, I'm from Salem, Oregon. I was at your one yesterday. I just have an interest, general interest in what I have to say.
Sure, welcome to the
Wayne Cross from North Vancouver, BC County. The previous two destinations.
So much.
Chris Kopke from Minneapolis. I've been in those sessions.
Roland James from Phoenix, Arizona. I've been in those sessions.
Bill Reeser from California, Alberta. I've been to Israel a couple of times. I have some Israeli friends. I've talked to some Israeli Arabs. And when we were talking last night about different perspectives, I can understand that very much.
Paul Doyle from North Vancouver, British Columbia. Had your session last night. Interested in the viability of the government, the Arab government, how much help they're getting and how realistic the expectations that they take on.
I just want to go back a little bit. In looking at the dilemma of satisfying the national rights of both Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs, the original idea in 1947, when the United Nations General Assembly got together on this issue, was to partition Palestine in half of it being a Jewish state and half of it being a Palestinian Arab state. There were people on both sides who accepted it, people on both sides who rejected that, but primarily the Israelis accepted it and the Arabs rejected it. And the Arabs felt that given the Jews controlled only 6% of Palestine at that time, it was unfair to give them half of it. And also they didn't like the idea of a Jewish state at all. In the heart of the Arab land, since they saw it as a neo-colonial or colonial settler kind of enterprise in the Arab heartland. Another part of the UN partition was that Jerusalem and its environs would be international under UN auspices. But as a result of the war, Arab countries attacking Israel and Israel forcibly expelling virtually the entire Arab population of the that were in the path of their army, ethnic cleansing, if you will. Israel ended up taking about around 77-78% of Palestine. Jerusalem was split right down the middle, complete with barbed wire and sentry post and the like. Jordan took over the remaining Arab parts of Eastern Palestine, which we now know as the West Bank. The Egyptians ended up taking over the narrow coastal strip. Mediterranean, and we now know by the Mediterranean we now know as the Gaza Strip. And the Palestinians and the Arabs continue to reject the existence of Israel. Their vision, some of the more extremist elements even called for physically wiping Israel off the map. The first chair of the PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization, a man by the name of Ahmed Shikari, even used the phrase, "We won't drive the Jews into the sea." And that wasn't very comforting for the Jews who suffered through the Holocaust, etc. Meanwhile, in the 1967 war, the Israelis ended up taking over the rest of Palestine and parts of surrounding Arab countries as well. The Arabs still stiffened their resistance to Israel. They in a conference in Khartoum, Sudan, the Arab League basically came out with a position of no recognition of Israel, no negotiations, no peace. Very hardline element. The United Nations in the Security Council in 1967 passed something called UN Security Council Resolution 242, which basically called for Israel to return to its internationally recognized borders. That's their expanded borders beyond 1948, but before the 1967 invasion. So again, about the 77% of Palestine. And in return for the Arab states recognizing Israel and having certain security guarantees for Israel. There was no mention of the Palestinians at all. Merely saying a just resolution to the refugee problem, because most of the Palestinians were refugees as a result of these wars. And so the Palestinian state that people had talked about back in 1947 had sort of been forgotten. Subsequent to that, the United Nations tried to pass a number of resolutions that were vetoed by the United States, which essentially reiterated 242, only with the proviso there'd be a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, but the U.S. rejected that. The UN General Assembly, by overwhelming majorities, did pass such resolutions. So basically you had three positions. One was the position of the PLO and the Arab states that Israel had no right to exist. It should all be a Palestinian state. The Israelis in the United States said there should be no Palestinian state, but maybe some kind of special status for these Arab lands, but certainly not Palestinian statehood. And the majority of the world, which was what are known as a two-state solution for a Palestinian mini-state in the West Bank and Gaza alongside Israel. Again, with some special status for Jerusalem. The PLO position evolved, though. In 1968, when Arafat and the Fatah guerrilla movement took over, they rejected this drive the Jews into the sea argument and instead said, okay, the Jews can stay, but as a democratic secular state. We will dismantle Zionist institutions, that is, the idea there should be separate, Jewish national entity, but the Jews themselves, they can just be Jewish Palestinians, just as 20% of the Palestinian population is Christian. They can be Christian Palestinians and Muslim Palestinians. Still, the Israelis didn't like this idea. They'd been been in so-called democratic secular states before, and had not fared too well. And in addition, there wasn't much a model of a democratic, secular anything in the Arab world. And the tactics of the PLO, including acts of terrorism, did not make them too optimistic that they'd fare well in this kind of state. So they still, understandably, rejected this proposal. But over the years, the PLO and the Arab states evolved to where they are today. That is, they recognize that for better or worse, Israel exists, and they need to live with it. That they cannot get all of Palestine back, they can't even get the 50% back that was promised them by the UN. They need to just take the 23% or so that's theirs, that's left, that's still mostly Palestinian, that was occupied by Israel since 1967. Meanwhile, however, with the election of a right-wing government in Israel in the late 1970s, the Israelis refused any kind of territorial compromise. They wanted all to be part of Israel proper. And so, since the mid to late 70s, the positions reversed. Israel's taken a much harder line than the PLO and the Arab states. though, and the U.S. government has essentially supported, with some minor variations, Israel's position of no Palestinian state. There have been a number of U.S. peace initiatives. One was known as the Rogers Plan, which is proposed by Nixon's Secretary of State, which basically allowed for Israel to hold on to some pieces of the territory seized in 67, but Jordan could administer the West Bank and Gaza in a demilitarized fashion. Kissinger, who was the National Security Advisor at the time, basically told the Israelis, don't pay any attention to Rogers, we don't. You got all the cards, why do you need to compromise? The next year, Anwar Sadat, who had taken over from Nasser after his death, proposed a similar deal. We will demilitarize the Sinai Peninsula if you return it to us in return for granting some form of autonomy to the Palestinians. Again, Kissinger advised the Israelis, why do you have to, you got all the cards, what's the point? And so the Israelis rejected that. So in response, 2 years later, a year and a half later, Egypt launched the 1973 October War. Well, then Kissinger realized they had to take the Arabs a little more seriously, so they had a number of piecemeal disengagements, which reopened the Suez Canal to international commerce and the like, but again, did not really address the underlying issues. It was a shuttle diplomacy, saying no comprehensive peace talks, but let the U.S. be an arbiter between individual Arab states to calm down the situations. There won't be war. There won't really be peace either, but the U.S. will increase its influence. That wasn't clearly enough for the Egyptians and others who were seeking peace. So Sadat had his famous trip to Jerusalem in 1977, and the Carter administration took over and came up with what was known as the Camp David Agreement. This has been depicted as a peace agreement, but in fact it was a tripartite military pact. A tripartite, that is three-way, military pact, which is to say that that as part of the so-called peace agreement, the U.S. promised to send $5 billion in additional arms to both Israel and Egypt, to send troops to the area, and in return for Israeli withdrawal from the Sinai Peninsula. But again, there were some provisions for Palestinian autonomy, but the Begin government refused to honor them, and the U.S. refused to enforce Israelis' word for Palestinian rights and the repression and the occupation and the settlements continued. Ron Young, who is who's head of the Interfaith Task Force for, the Interreligious Committee for Middle East Peace, and a former representative of the American Friends Service Committee, has written a book about the Reagan years called Missed Opportunities for Peace, where he talks about five or six places where there are very clear opportunities for Israeli-Palestinian peace, Israeli-Arab peace, and the Reagan administration either blocked them or failed to follow through or do the obvious things that they needed to do. But instead insist on continuing to send arms to both Israel and the Arab states and to refuse to include the Palestinians in any peace negotiations. Finally, after the Gulf War, the next big step that happened was 1988 with the rise of the Palestinian Intifada. The Palestinians in the occupied territories with a mixture of non-violent resistance and rock throwing had a large-scale uprising against the Israeli occupation. And just as Arabs, including other Palestinians, realized that Israel existed and they had to deal with it, the Israelis sort of said, hey, we got to deal with the Palestinians here. They may not be a state, but by golly, they haven't given up on being a nation, a people with distinct rights. And you found more and more dissent in Israel against the occupation. You saw large-scale draft resistance for the first time. Not about draft resistance per se, that is, people were willing to serve in the Israeli army, but they weren't less and less than were willing to serve in the occupied territories. Still, the U.S. took a very hard line, increased aid to Israel, to stamp out the tax resistance and civil disobedience and the strikes and the riots and other forms of resistance against Israeli military rule. Finally, after the Gulf War, the U.S. Organized a series of peace talks that began in Madrid. And the ground rules the U.S. laid out was there would not be a comprehensive peace, but bilateral negotiations. Many critics saw this as a kind of divide and rule kind of thing. And the Palestine Liberation Organization, which the international community and virtually all Palestinians saw as, in effect, Palestinian government exile. Indeed, the PLO declared Palestinian independence in December of 1988, and had been recognized by more nations than recognized Israel. The U.S. refused to allow the PLO to take part. Instead, they said, if the Palestinians want to come, they have to come as members of the Jordanian delegation. And the United States and Israel could veto whoever they wanted who was in the Palestinian delegation. It's the first peace talks in history, I know, where another party could say who the other party brought as their peace team. Still, while these rules are blatantly unfair, the Jordanians, who didn't like this deal either, I mean, they knew they weren't going to represent the Palestinians, and the Palestinians didn't represent them, essentially gave their Palestinian members autonomy. So in effect, it was two separate delegations, even though the U.S. insisted that they were one. And the Palestinians who did come, even though they weren't part of the PLO, basically were in close contact with the PLO throughout the process. So it wasn't as unfair as it may have seemed. But they really didn't get that far. Because the Begin government, the right-wing government in power, and they've since admitted this, were basically using the peace process as a stalling tactic so to increase the Israeli colonization of the occupied territories to create facts on the ground where any kind of Palestinian autonomy or independence or whatever would be impossible. And the U.S. Refused to tie its massive amounts of aid to Israel to ending the settlements and the like. And but the Bush administration started to realize, hey, wait a minute. You know, we don't want Palestinian statehood or anything, but the policies of the Shamir government, the right-wing government in Israel, are so hard-lined, so intransigent, it could create great instability in the Middle East. After the Gulf War, it's getting all self-righteous about international law and how military occupation is wrong and that kind of thing. We're seeing a bunch of hypocrites in the Arab world. The only way we got away with the Gulf War is we promised the Arab states we'd get some movement here on the Palestinian question. So they started to pressure, somewhat. Not threatening to cut aid or do anything like that, but at least verbally nudging Israel for the first time to move. When Israel said, hey, we need a $10 billion loan guarantee because, you know, this occupation is real expensive, the Bush administration said, sure, if you stop building these settlements, expanding these Israeli illegal settlements. Well, people reacted 80% of the American public, according to public opinion polls, agreed with Bush, either agreed with Bush that they should tie these loans to ending the settlements, or not give the loans at all until Israel stopped the occupation or stopped the human rights violations, etc. However, all six Democratic candidates for president in 1992, including Tom Harkin, Jerry Brown, Bill Clinton, all of them, attacked the Bush administration from the right, saying you should give these loans automatically. In fact, you know, Clinton and Harkin, all these people insisted this is just humanitarian aid to help refugees from the Soviet Union. Well, as a matter of fact, I've been to Israel recently. I've been to Beersheba, the main processing point for incoming immigrants from the former Soviet Union. There are 5,000 empty housing units in Beersheba alone. There's a housing surplus in Israel. Indeed, this loan guarantee for housing for refugees was a ruse. But the pressure got strong enough that Bush finally ended up agreeing to the loan guarantees, thanks to the Democrats and some right-wing Republicans. And the loan guarantees came through. However, he was able to stall until after the June 1992 Israeli election, which brought in the Labor government, which was a more moderate Israeli government. And even though the human rights abuse has actually increased, and even though the Labor government is equally opposed to Palestinian statehood, they were willing to move a little bit in some of the areas that the Bush administration had been encouraging. And so what happened was when they saw how the peace agreements were stalled. And so basically the U.S. said, okay, we'll make a compromise agreement, which ended up being more hard-line than the Israeli position, vis-a-vis the Palestinians. So there's a lot of disillusionment about the way the peace talks are going. The only way they could break the stalemate was the Israelis and PLO said, hey, we can't rely on the United States. We have to go. We have to do it on our own. And using the good offices of the Norwegian Foreign Ministry, they had, for months, they had secret talks around Oslo and came up with the Declaration of Principles, which took place in which were signed in Washington, D.C. in this past September. And please take in mind, this came, despite, not because of the United States, and while the Clinton administration and most of the U.S. Congress was basically arguing that, you know, Israel should not have to talk to the PLO. The Israelis realized they did, despite what the United States was pushing. The accord granted the Palestinians self-rule in the Gaza Strip and in Jericho, a city on the West Bank, which would expand eventually to most of the rest of the occupied territories. And there'd be mutual recognition between Israel and the PLO. Now, there are many positive aspects to this agreement. The U.S., while Israel still refuses to recognize Palestine as a state, they implicitly recognize the Palestinians as a nation. Up to this time, Israel had pretty much denied the very existence of the Palestinians as a separate entity. They lumped them together with other Arabs. The PLO, meanwhile, had codified their previous recognition of Israel, strengthening the language and deleting parts of the PLO Charter, which called for the dismantling of Israel. And while the West Bank and Gaza under this agreement would still be Israeli-occupied territories, they would not be an independent state, and Israeli troops could still pretty much go around at will and intervene whenever they deemed necessary, etc., the occupation would be less visible, therefore less repressive. It would allow the development of autonomous political institutions denied under Israeli occupations, any kind of Palestinian political or economic entity separate from the Israeli occupation was deemed illegal and would be subjected to sending people to jail from membership in something. Obviously that changed. It would allow badly economic development that stagnated under the Israeli occupation. And of course, there's the symbolic importance that they're talking to each other, they shook hands. That's very, very important. There's also many negative aspects to the agreement. One is it's very vague. And the Palestinians had a mistake of in the final drafting did not have anyone there who was really fluent in English, nor did they have any lawyers with them. And so the Israelis can get away with a lot by virtue of the language, not to mention their centuries-old Talmudic tradition, which could really twist a lot of the vague language to their favor. Also, it says basically vaguely the issues of settlements will be settled years later, and Jerusalem will be settled again down the road a couple years later. And basically the Clinton administration has used this to reverse previous administration's policies by saying, well, even though the United Nations Security Council agreed unanimously, even with U.S. support, that Jerusalem is occupied territory, part of the West, East Jerusalem is occupied territory along the rest of the West Bank, and even though the UN Security Council with U.S. support has agreed that settlements are illegal, this agreement says is neutral on it. So we are now therefore neutral, and the U.S. has effectively vetoed and prevented any movement on these issues. The U.S. refuses to refer to the settlements is illegal. First U.S. administration to do so. Also, the Clinton administration even refuses to call the West Bank and Gaza occupied territories. They're disputed territories, implying that both sides have equal claim to the land. Both the Palestinians that lived there for centuries and the Israelis who invaded in 1967, the Clinton administration is now saying, you know, these are in effect equal claimants to the land, and we're just being neutral. The problem, so in effect, they allow the it allows the occupation to continue in many respects. The Israelis can veto any elected or appointed official. And you know, the future stages, whether it'll lead to Palestinian statehood or not, again, are left vague and essentially up to whether the Israelis want to do it or not. The PLO has essentially played all their cards. And the only other pressure from Israel could either come from the peace movement or from its left wing, which is not is a force, but not a real strong force, or from the outside, in the United States, which, you know, has refused to do so. And again, is to the right of the Israeli government in many key aspects here, at least under Clinton. So there's a real dilemma in that the Israelis in the United States hold most of the cards, and the vagueness is an advantage of the status quo. So whether this will move beyond being essentially a Palestinian Bantustan, if you will, or, you know, something where there's they can control the sewer and, you know, and issue marriage licenses and, you know, that kind of thing, as opposed to anything that will be real freedom, real independence, is a matter of real serious question. Also left unresolved is other Israeli occupied territories such as southern Lebanon and southwestern Syria. The Syrian regime, under the leadership of a pretty nasty dictator by the name of Hafez Assad, has also evolved quite a bit over the years. It essentially agreed to 242, basically saying, okay, give us back the Golan Plateau, you know, which is Syrian territory, which Israel took over in 67, again expelled most of the Syrians who lived there. Just give it back to us, and in return we'll, you know, demilitarize, we will allow international peacekeeping monitors, you know, whatever, you know, meet all these security guarantees. The Israelis have so far refused. They're holding out for full recognition. And what the Syrians say is, hey, 242 said nothing about full recognition. All it said was security guarantees, and we're willing to give this to you. But the U.S. is essentially taking the Israeli line. There needs to be full recognition and security guarantees first, and then maybe we can talk about withdrawing from at least some of the territories. The UN is more clear on Lebanon, which Israel seized in 1978, saying you have to withdraw immediately and unconditionally. That's the same language that was used about Iraq vis-a-vis Kuwait, but again, the U.S. has refused to enforce that as well. Yeah.
In some point of view, this probably has to go to Lebanon. What's happening there?
Sure.
I'm happy
to. And meanwhile, virtually all Arab states, with the exceptions of maybe Libya and Iraq, have been willing to formally recognize Israel, open up economic ties, etc., but only when the Palestinian situation is resolved. And so this remains the main stumbling block. They agreed to end their economic embargo of Israel, etc., in a state of war, in return for Palestinian independence. But again, that seems to be a ways off. Ironically, though, among the Israeli people, and among American Jews, or I say plurality, depending on how the polls is phrased, majority of Israelis and a majority of North American Jews support are open to Palestinian statehood. The Israeli government, the U.S. government, that is still blocking that. And that's sort of the dilemma where we're in right now.
Can you comment on why the policy of the United States has been such as it has?
It's hard to say. I think we oppose primarily the idea of Palestinian statehood is a little frightening to us, because the idea of an Arab state or any Middle Eastern state that came into existence as a result of a popular struggle by their people, as opposed to monarchies which we can work with and deal with, might be a bad precedent. I think also that the state of war, and again, I'm not sure, I don't want to sound overly conspiratorial, like this is a conscious policy, but in effect, the state of war has enabled the U.S. to arm both sides. We've been able to use Israel as a strategic asset in that part of the world. And the idea of Israeli technology, Palestinian industries, and Arabian oil wealth combining, transforming the Middle East, what would that do to American oil companies, arms manufacturers, Pentagon, It could really, the American hegemony, which we value so much. I think there are two other factors. One is that American liberals, at least in elected offices, have tended to be even more hardline than Republican administrations. And that in part has to do with the right-wing Jewish establishment is fairly well organized politically as lobbyists, contributors to election campaigns, etc. But I think more important than that is that the peace movement and the churches have not taken the Middle East on the same kind of urgency that we took on Central America, South Africa, the arms race, and other issues. So I think, frankly, it's less of a power of a pro-Israel lobby and the weakness of a pro-peace lobby. And so Clinton, which frankly I don't think really cares that much about foreign policy, well, just defers to the military-industrial complex, to the establishment, because he's not getting countervailing forces from Congress or from the American public. So even the American public, by big margin, says we should tie USA to Israel, to human rights and international law, and we should support Palestinian state alongside Israel, etc. If people aren't really mobilizing around that, and the pressure from, again, the Pentagon and right-wing special interest groups and the political establishment is in the other direction, he'll just defer to where the more powerful influences are. I'll be talking about this in a little more detail in my Friday workshop, which looks in more detail at the U.S. role. I'm sorry for being so U.S. focused for you Canadians. But
that's why we're here.
One of the things we heard the other night when we talked about the failure of the church in supporting the peace role was a statement that the organized church has no business supporting anything. Mm-hmm. And if we're satisfied with that kind of a church, we are hard pressed to support our ethics.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think some of the real exciting things that I've seen have been the way that the many parts of the Israeli peace movement and Palestinian nationalists have been working together. When there was a thing three years ago, I think, when Palestinians and Israeli peace activists, as well as people from peace groups and church groups from around the world, made a big linked arms around the Old City. It's around Christmas time. Israeli troops came in and badly beat a good chunk of the protesters and threw in tear gas, and it was a real nasty scene. But it was a very powerful statement that of people coming together like that. Another example was the a group of Palestinian exiles and with the help of some European churches got a boat to sail to Haifa, which is now in Israel, to symbolize their return through the blockade, as had the Zionist in the famous episode back in the late 30s. Again, fortunately, the Israelis ended up blowing up the ship. Fortunately, no one was on it at the time. It's still dark. But again, it was an example of people coming together. When Israeli troops, right, when settlers have cut down vineyards or olive groves, Israeli peace activists come and try to replant them. Israelis, along with Palestinians, have put their bodies in front of bulldozers that were, you know, destroying Arab farms to make way for new settlements. We have we've seen some very exciting efforts over there by people generally committed to peace. We don't hear about them very much. But I remember seeing a episode outside Halhul, a small Palestinian village in the West Bank, where an Israeli sculptor had made a statue. It was out in the vineyard where the vines would actually kind of grow up and eventually take it over, the sign of growth and hope. There's a pile of rocks in the middle, again, that would soon be obscured by greenery, again, symbolic of hope. And it was also for the mayor of that town who'd been expelled by the Israelis for his advocacy of nonviolent resistance to the occupation. And the speech is commemorating this statue. And you had both Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs talking about a two-state solution, talking about peace. And at that point, I saw a whole bunch of Israeli troops coming over the hill to break up this illegal demonstration. And I saw, and they came in, they're there to arrest Palestinians for taking part in a political activity. And then I saw a bunch of Israelis link arms, placing themselves between the Israeli troops and the Palestinians, and saying, if you arrest them, you're going to have to arrest us first. This included some members of the Knesset, maybe the members of the Israeli parliament are among these who were doing this, and they didn't want to that kind of showdown, so they backed away. The thing I remember the most was seeing tears in the eyes of Palestinians in this village who had never seen an Israeli stick up for them, because the only Israelis they knew were the people who came in their home in the middle of the night and dragged away their brother or father and smashed up the furniture or whatever. And so I think there are many episodes like this that are happening. And I remember when last I flew into Israel, I remember talking to him. I saw this Israeli businessman who had been to London. He was jotting down his little portable computer names he had on a little card of business contacts. They were all Arab names already. And a similar thing happened when I was in Dubai, which is a big Arab trade center on the Persian Gulf, part of the United Arab Emirates. They're making contact. They're looking forward to normal economic trade. In fact, there's a fair amount of going on clandestinely already. Most Israelis, a lot of people don't know this, are Middle Eastern in origin. These are third world people. They are Middle Eastern people. You go to a Sephardic marketplace in Israel, you might as well be in an Arab marketplace in Damascus or Cairo or somewhere. So there's movement there. Regarding Lebanon, after years of civil war, here's relative peace.
Who are the players in the civil war?
Well, originally, it's been many, many sided. Initially, it was between a number of right-wing, in fact, in one case, in terms of the phalangists, an extreme right-wing group known as the Phalangists. The Phalangists were modeled after Hitler Youth. They're a very openly fascist organization. And they became the dominant party of the Maronite Christians, which is a large minority. The Maronites are Catholic Rite, but independent from Rome. versus a large grouping of which included the left, some Orthodox and Protestant Christians, secular forces, and the Muslim majority in a group known as the Lebanese National Movement. And the Lebanese National Movement, and actually also had got later, about 6 months into the war, the PLO joined on the side of the Lebanese National Movement, were on the verge of winning. The French and the U.S. were clandestinely siding with the Maronites, as were the Israelis, with the Falangists. And finally, Syria invaded on the side of the Falangists. The Syrians cynically wanted to maintain some kind of equilibrium in Lebanon so they could dominate. And they were also afraid if the Lebanese National Movement won, Israel would invade and would be a threat to Syrian security. There was this... a stalemate for a while. Syrians would switch sides periodically to make sure this equilibrium was maintained. In 1978, the Israelis invaded the southern part of the country at a cost of nearly 2,000 civilian lives in retaliation of a Palestinian terrorist attack that killed about 30 Israeli civilians. The U.S. And other countries, you know, pushed Israel to withdraw from all but maybe a 12-mile strip. The Israelis set up a right-wing mercenary army known as the South Lebanese Army, run by this renegade Lebanese army major by the name of Haddad, who got most of his funding from right-wing North American Protestants, fundamentalist groups. Pat Robertson and his crowd raised a lot of money for them, even set up a radio station. In fact, I remember traveling in between Sidon and Tyre during this period in South Lebanon, turning on my radio station and hearing American gospel music, and interspersed with Haddad talking Arabic, saying he would shell the city of Sidon if the Lebanese government would give him $20 million. And they just shelled a UN post and killed 20 UN soldiers a few days before, a pretty notorious guy. And then they go back with Christian Broadcasting. Very ironic, because even though in the fundraising literature for the station they say they're preparing the Jewish soul for the Messiah, you know, and they want to be there live to broadcast the Second Coming, they're supported by the Israeli government. The Israeli army brought in the equipment for this radio station and the like. These are basically these Christian outposts against the Muslim communist satanic forces that are attacking them. And very bizarre situation, which maintains in Lebanon to this day. They don't have a TV station to go with a radio station. So you had that going on in the south. Finally, 1982, Israel had a full-scale invasion, even though there had been, ostensibly to wipe out the PLO military threat, but there had been a ceasefire in place for more than a year. The cross-border shelling had been going on periodically before that had long since stopped. Israelis ended up killing nearly, by Red Cross estimates, about 20,000 Lebanese, 80% of whom were civilians. And you may remember the siege of Beirut and the like. And under Israeli guns, they brought the Falangists into power and as a formal government. Indeed engineered a Falangist massacre of thousands of Palestinians in refugee camps in that area. And when the Lebanese people then rose up against this right-wing minority Falangist government, the UN sent in the Navy, U.S. sent in the Navy to bomb the strongholds of the opposition. As a result of this, another party came into the conflict in Lebanon that had been dormant for quite a few years, or had been non-existent, and that is an Islamic fundamentalist element. Because the so-called Muslims in the early stages of the civil war were actually this larger secular grouping, whereas these were Shiite, real hard-line fundamentalist types, which have ended up playing a major role in Lebanese politics. These are the guys that hijacked, you know, American and other foreign workers, assassinated a number of foreigners, have periodically have attacked Israeli patrols in southern Lebanon and the like. So while the Lebanese government Well, eventually the Falangist government collapsed and the Falangists were defeated. They were actually supported by Iraq for a while. A conservative, but fairly open democratic government has now emerged in Lebanon since around 1991, and it's and most of the militias have been disarmed. It's the Syrians still are major players. They still have troops there. In many ways, it's comparable to the relationship between Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. That, you know, they're independent and can do a lot of their own things, but on certain foreign policy issues and on certain key cabinet posts, you know, you need to get the approval of the big brother, you know. And so things are looking up, but you still, one militias they weren't really able to disarm was the fundamentalist militias in the south, Hezbollah, known as the Party of God. Nor have they been able to disarm the Israeli occupation forces or the South Lebanese army, which is the Israeli mercenary force that are still in the southern part. That's essentially where the stalemate is right now. In retaliation for a series of attacks by Hezbollah against Israeli troops in occupied southern Lebanon, the Israelis launched a major bombarding of hundreds of Lebanese villages, hundreds of casualties, tens of thousands of refugees. This happened about this time last year, you may recall. And out of that came some kind of ceasefire. In retaliation, Hezbollah people actually started shelling northern Israel for the first time in quite a few years. Once again, the U.S. side with Israel in that dispute, but it's still some problems in the south, but most of Lebanon seems to be finally putting itself together after many years of bloodshed. It was never a clean-cut Christian-Muslim dispute, as it was often depicted in the media, because the reason they had that war in the first place was that when the French left, they put up what was known as confessional representation, that the president would always be a Maronite Christian. The head of the prime minister would always be a Sunni Muslim. The Speaker of the House would be a Shiite Muslim, down to the Greek Orthodox and the Druze and the Armenians, I mean, all the different factions. And basically what it did was not only was it unfair because it gave the Maronite minority a disproportionate power, but it also led to a kind of feudalistic kind of system where you had feudal elites of all the various communities essentially running things from the top down. So you never got a democratic political culture, even though in many respects it was more open and democratic than almost any country in the Arab world. It was a plutocratic elite system that favored the wealthy and powerful elements at the expense of the majority. And in certain ways it happened to parallel religious lines, you know, like Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland, or the, you know, Muslims and Orthodox and Catholics in former Yugoslavia. But it wasn't a religious conflict per se. It was about class, it was about power, it was about privilege and the like. It's a very complicated situation. I hope I've nailed it.
That's very helpful. Is Beirut being rebuilt?
Yeah, it is actually. The Lebanese president happens to be a multi-billionaire with a lot of Saudi contacts, and he's using some of his personal wealth and his Saudi friends to really try to rebuild. It's a beautiful city, and it's such a tragedy. Have you been there?
No, but I heard it was a beautiful city before it was destroyed.
What's it called? Paris of the
Middle East. The country was called Switzerland in the Middle East, because it was diverse ethnically and peaceful and neutral and the like. But you know, the mountains go right down to the sea, and it's like Palestine, historic Palestine. It's a very fertile area.
Palestine is before the big division, and you know, how did it relate to what was originally Israel, which of course varied from time to time?
Oh yeah, and that's part of the. I mean, there are a lot of Israelis that say, you know, Israel should be what it was in the time of Solomon, which was most of the Middle East.
Yeah.
And you'll talk to a lot of you know, fundamentalist Jews who are very open about that. They won't be satisfied until they have it all. In fact, the party that dominated Israel for much of the late 70s, throughout the 80s, until just recently, their official anthem was, "There are two sides of the Jordan," meaning that they don't just want the West Bank, they want the East Bank. In fact, their flag is a picture of a Solomon-sized Israel with a clenched fist with a gun. This was the Israeli government ruling party for, you know, that the U.S. was so avidly supporting. In fact, I saw a recent fundraising letter from Bob Packwood, the senator from Oregon, and his, in talking about how he supported Israel, his map of Israel was just that map, to give you an idea where Senator was the U.S. senator coming from. But basically, now of course, another interesting thing about it is that there are periods when there was more than one Jewish state in that part of the world, and as well as states by a whole number of other people. It wasn't, you know, exclusively or even primarily Jewish. But the let me think of it as the British mandate of Palestine. Excuse my magic drawing here. Okay, here's the Dead Sea, here's the Sea of Galilee. Jordan's over here, and Lebanon's up here, and Syria's up here, and Egypt is down here. The traditional Judea was sort of, I guess, around this area. Samaria, Syria, Galilee, talking about up here. When the kingdom was united, it included a little bit into us now, southern Lebanon, and sort of around, kind of around like this, I guess, and then the Hittite Empire, even a further swath of land. Never got down to this part very much. And Gaza over here was historically the Philistine capital, where Samson brought down the temple. And now this is Gaza Strip, and this is the West Bank, and there's Jerusalem. So there's post-Palestinian main state would be these two sections.
In terms of fertility of land and the ability to sustain livelihood, are those sections reasonable?
This area is fairly fertile. Much of the West Bank, sort of the northern and western sections, and by fertile I mean, you know, California type fertile. We're not talking lush and green, but we're talking, you know, grapes, almonds, nuts, citrus, you know, that kind of, or actually citrus is more in the low area in Gaza, but and certainly, you know, herding and other things. But also, you know, even prior to the creation of Israel, these were primarily town dwellers and merchants. The Palestinians, you know, like the Phoenicians and others, have traditionally been traders, and unlike many other Arabs, they're largely nomadic. They have a more sedentary kind of thing, so it wouldn't primarily be agricultural anyway. And they're also very educated. I mean, the number of Palestinians equals about the number of Israelis, and there are more Palestinian college graduates than there are Israeli college graduates. These are highly educated people. And also, not every Palestinian is going to go back to an independent Palestinian state any more than every Jew is going to go to Israel. So they're certainly capable of a larger population. And besides, we're not talking about... And also the question, of course, can it be a state if they're not economically viable? Where most nation states in the world are not economically viable, but it doesn't mean they don't have a right to to statehood. This area is pretty desert. This is Judean wilderness. And this looks like, I think any of you there in the southern Utah, but, you know, it's beautiful, but it's not, can't do much with it. Gaza, there's some, you know,
there's a fair amount of citrus, but it's a little drier as well. It's very overcrowded.
Much of the refugees crowd in this
area. Yeah, so we're talking about 500 people per square mile, a very compact area.
And part of this autonomy agreement is that the Israelis still control a third of the Gaza Strip. So even when you say Palestinian autonomy in the Gaza Strip, we're talking about only two-thirds of the Gaza Strip. Because, you know, there's been widespread land confiscation. I mean, the Israelis control directly half of the West Bank. So even if we have Palestinian autonomy, it's only going to be half of what you see on the map, again, unless there is some agreement reached on the whole settlement question, which the, neither Rabin or Clinton appear ready to budge on at this point.
Back in 1948, when this 50-50 split was proposed, what was the various populations at that point? I assume that the Jews would be less than 50% of that time. They not.
Oh yeah, they only control 6% of the land. There may be somewhere between 20-30% of the population. So that was one reason the Arabs rejected it. And they included large areas that were almost exclusively Arabs in this Jewish proposed Jewish state.
And right now, it's what, a 50-50 split based on population.
Yeah, actually, Palestinians have a higher growth rate. So it's but of course, you also have the massive immigration of Jews to Israel since the since independence. Had a big wave from Arab countries in the 1950s, and then you've had this new wave from the former Soviet Union, which has come on, which has come since then.
Are you saying that's drying up, or is there all these empty homes? There's less people coming from Soviet?
No, just that there's not quite as many as they expected, but it's still, and they expected as much as 2 million, they've got maybe 400,000, but 400,000 in a state of 4 million is still a pretty, you know, dramatic increase. Incidentally, Jordan had to absorb more Palestinians than from the Gulf when they were expelled after the Gulf War than Israel absorbed Jews. And Jordan's half the population of Israel and maybe 1/20th of the economy. But no one was talking about a loan guarantee to to Jordan. I think, but let me just mention, just to end on a hopeful note, that, remember, 25 years ago, most people hadn't even heard the word Palestinian. If you were Palestinian from the West Bank, you were Jordanian. When the American Friends Service Committee, which is the first North American Christian denomination to come out with a major study on peace in the Middle East, called for a two-state solution, they were roundly attacked. I mean, pilloried, slandered. I mean, just incredible. But now that position is the position of virtually every mainline church in America. And indeed, people are actively talking about it. Resolutions 242 didn't mention anything about Palestinian rights or statehood. Now, virtually every country in the world supports Palestinian statehood, again, U.S. and Israel being the exception. On the other hand, 25 years ago, virtually most Arab states and most of the third world didn't recognize Israel. Now, virtually all countries either recognize Israel or are on the verge of recognizing Israel, assuming there's resolution to Palestine. You have Arafat and Rabin shaking hands. You have there's progress, there's movement. This is good. This is exciting. It's hopeful. You have Palestinian representatives are seen not as hooded terrorists, but, you know, articulate, educated women like Hanan Ashrari, incidentally, is a Christian. Devout Anglican, actually. There was no Israeli peace movement to speak of 25 years ago, 20 years ago. I've been involved in this stuff for years, and there's a lot, there's a lot of frustrations. I hope I haven't emphasized the negative aspects
too much. I do that a little bit just because I think a lot of people after last September thought, oh, okay, it's just a matter of time, everything's going to work out, but, which is not the case. But at the same time, there's some very, very positive things.